In the summer, after my second year of seminary, I was attending General Assembly, which is the yearly denominational conference, the Unitarian Universalist Association General Assembly. And that year, the Reverend Mark Morrison Reed gave the sermon in the great big worship service that happens at GA on Sunday morning. An African American, Mark grew up in the First Unitarian Church of Chicago. He has written books about UU history, in particular about racial issues in our history and civil rights. His sermon at GA that year was about some other topic, but it was provocative and stirring. Later that day in the convention center hallway, I saw a group of friends, including John Gilmore, who was ahead of me in seminary a couple of years. John is a black man, but he really doesn't look like Mark. John reported that several white people had come up to him in the hallway of the convention center to praise him for the sermon, which the other man had given. John was good-natured as he told this, and I laughed at the stupid mistake of those strangers. How funny. I didn't realize that if such a thing happens to you over and over, it may not be so funny. I saw John at this year's General Assembly, and I reminded him of this story, and I received his permission to tell it to you. John says that he continues to be mistaken for one black man or another. This is called a microaggression. In the words of Professor Darrell Wing Su, microaggressions are the continuing everyday slights, insults, and indignities visited upon marginalized groups by well-intentioned, moral, and decent people. Microaggressions exist as a reflection of social bias against people because of race, gender, and sexual orientation, among other categories. They are the subtle social tools that tell some people from some groups, stay in your place. They're not overt, like a hate crime or bigoted slur, not usually harmful to one's employment. Compared to overt violence, microaggressions are like paper cuts. But constant and regular paper cuts do take a toll. They hurt. They wear down the spirit. I've heard of parents going to pick up their kids after school and being treated with suspicion because they were not the color of their kids, or because one parent was of the same gender of the parent who had brought in the kids to the class earlier that day. I've heard more than one story of a Latino out mowing his lawn when a car pulls up and the driver asks how much he charges for gardening service. The invisible microaggression is the message: you're out of place. People of your group don't belong here. It's not a burning cross in the yard by the KKK, but a paper cut. And these add up. Several years ago, a member of this congregation asked me, "Who's Pablo, and when did we hire him?" That's not his real name, but he was a Latino. He was a volunteer, part of our congregation, a new part of our congregation back then. And he would come after work to water the trees on our campus. Pablo wasn't a new custodian. Ouch. Women who became college professors in the 1960s and 70s have told stories of campus cocktail parties. They often received this opening question: "Which professor is your husband?" I've read stories of women attorneys new in law firms getting the question, "Whose secretary are you?" While women are no longer kept out of academia or the legal profession, the message of the microaggression was, "You don't really belong here, do you?" In 1992, as the board president of my church in Chicago, I arranged for our brand new district executive from the UUA to lead a planning retreat for the whole congregation. She wasn't the first woman to be our district executive, but our congregation had not met her yet. Wearing a long skirt, she came to our Friday night kickoff dinner, which we held upstairs at a Chicago restaurant in a banquet hall. As she made her way to the restroom through the tables of the banquet hall, she got two orders for Chardonnay. That never would have happened to a bishop. Daryl Wing Su notes that these little aggressions come from fair-minded people who would never intentionally wish to discriminate. We would like to treat everybody fairly and with respect. We strive to. Yet negative attitudes are held widely in society, and they do make their way out of our mouths. We can be the unwitting and unwilling enforcers of the structures of privilege, prejudice, and oppression, structures which are built into every society in different ways. Are you married? Are you married? Why aren't you married? Back in the 1980s, before lesbian and gay people were as visible as we are now, I got that question a lot. Are you married? Why aren't you married? Haven't you found the right girl yet? Nobody intended to oppress me, but here's how it did. Such questions assume a box that everyone fits into. They imply that if you don't fit, there is something wrong with you. In 1982, I was talking to my college academic advisor at the coffee hour at the local UU church. She asked, "Do you have a girlfriend?" Instead of dancing around the truth, I tried a straightforward answer. "Well, I guess I haven't told you, but I'm gay and single." I weighed the decision about how much to say. I had high regard for her and affection, but I wondered how truthful should I be when I didn't know if she would accept me. What about my standing in the academic program? The risk of not being respected felt like a real one. "Oh, well, that's okay," she said. "But I don't really like it when they flaunt being gay." Ouch. After I went home, I thought about how I could have responded to that. "Oh, are you saying you wish I hadn't told you that? How much honesty would be considered flaunting? Should I never bring it up again?" There were so many ways she could have responded that would have shown caring and thoughtful curiosity. She could have said, "Oh, thank you for telling me." She could have asked, "What has it been like for you as a gay student at our college?" In that exchange, I felt the worries familiar to people whose identity is seen as being on the fringe of society. That could include not only lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people, but women, people of color, or people with disabilities. Microaggressions can happen to fat people. "My, that's a lot of food," we might blurt out. Or, "You're going to have dessert?" "And to skinny people too. Are you okay? Are you eating enough?" Or, "Here, have another helping. Put some meat on those bones." Verbal paper cuts can happen to anyone, any of us. We all stumble and step on one another's toes. Anybody can do it, and anyone can feel it. However, as Professor Wing Su notes, microaggressions are most harmful to persons from groups that historically have been disdained, disregarded, or kept on the margins of society. A lot of us, when we are made aware of how we have participated in a little aggression, will suddenly feel the heat of shame. We may withdraw. I'm not a bad person. I have felt shame rising up in me when I have realized my goof and the hurt that my words have caused. Resignation, anger, that's another way to respond. I guess we can't ask anything, can't bring up anything anymore. This is an understandable feeling. We don't want to step on a landmine, and we don't want to feel the embarrassment of harming another person. Yet it is important to note that people on the receiving end of a little aggression have to ask themselves all the time whether they will say anything. Will they confront a comment that misrepresents them? Or after receiving an unintentional insult, will they instead smile and change the subject? Will they choose quietly to nurse one more slight until they are somewhere else in a safe space to tell someone they trust? Or will they say, "Ouch"? Will they see if we are curious enough to know why they said "ouch" when we haven't intended to cause injury? To monitor yourself constantly, to balance staying quiet when you are the recipient of little aggressions versus speaking up about them, it can be a burden. What are you? What are you? A woman I knew in another UU congregation heard this question a lot, sometimes in church, but mostly at work and in public. She was a flight attendant. She was a lovely woman of light brown skin. What are you? A mother of two, she could say. No, what are you? She would say, "I'm an American." No, what is your race? Her heritage was African, Irish, and Native American. What are you? Do people who ask demeaning questions like that even deserve to know something as intimate as her family heritage? When we say hurtful things, as well-meaning as you or I might be, it's not the responsibility of the person we hurt to educate us about the bias we are revealing or the paper cut we're causing. It's not their job. No, it is our job as people of conscience to learn and reflect on how we might be intruding on another's tender places. Perhaps we could hold back some of our eagerness, some of our curiosity, until another person chooses to share what they would share. For example, we could say, "Tell me about yourself, if you don't mind. I'm curious." "Oh, say whatever you'd like to, and I can tell you a bit about myself, if you'd like." Most of us will make assumptions that we don't recognize or examine, and we may act on them before thinking. All of us, whoever we are, can strive to be more mindful and thoughtful as we seek to respect one another for who we are, to accept our differences and to learn from them. We all need to move with more grace in this world. When we're not putting our own foot in our mouth, we can be a good ally. There are a few ways we can try to be a good ally if we see another person on the receiving end of a little aggression. Taking our friend aside later, we could ask, "Did what that person say to you come across to you the way it would come across to me? Did it hurt? I'm sorry. I regret the times I could have done something like that and failed. For those on the receiving end of those little bias-based aggressions, it's helpful to have someone listen, to have their experience taken seriously and not invalidated. Validation of your experience can mean a lot. Another way to be an ally: after we hear a hurtful remark, we could wait for a break in the conversation, then take the offending party aside. Do you realize how that came across? This is how it came across to me. Privately, we can explain how their well-intentioned question was harmful. We could suggest alternatives for the future. Or an ally could interrupt right away. "Ouch! I can't believe you said that." This is pretty aggressive itself, but sometimes it may be called for. Recently in rural Rhode Island, I visited a UU family I have been friends with since I spent a year there as a ministerial intern 20 years ago. The dad of the family is brown-skinned, both African-American and Native American. In the past year, he's been pulled over twice by police in Rhode Island. He is 72 years old. Not long ago, he was driving a pickup truck that he had borrowed from a church friend. He was pulled over and his license was checked. Why? The officer said there was no license plate on the front of the truck. When he finished his trip and arrived at the home of the white friend who had lent him her truck, she broke into tears. And they saw that there was, in fact, a license plate on the front of the truck. She called up her small town's police department. She told them what had happened to her friend. She probably wasn't very polite. She was outraged. She insisted on an apology for him. Soon a knock at the door, and the officer was there to apologize to both of them. All of us can find something that we feel hurt about, I think. I know I can. Everybody can feel like an outsider with respect to some aspect of who you are. I've been serving congregations as a minister or as a lay leader for 30 years. It never fails that people come to me privately and say that they don't fit in. They feel like an outsider. These are genuine feelings, perhaps with some bad experiences to back them up. But you know, if I introduced everybody who felt that way to everybody else who felt that way, we would have a large crowd. We could start a congregation. But of course, we've already got one. Our UU religious movement was founded by people who didn't fit in by one measure or another. Yet they felt called together by the values of our common humanity, dignity, thoughtfulness, and compassion. We always benefit from added learning and from practicing as we strive to live out these values. We affirm our shared humanity by accepting our uniqueness and by exploring our differences with respect. There is no cure for the curse of the paper cuts, but we can try to reduce their frequency. We can learn to make more space for empathy and understanding. We can resist that urge to fill the air all the time, to fill the air with intrusive questions or presumptuous opinions. Often this is simple as not speaking, holding our tongue. Not forever, but pausing long enough to be present to what we're thinking, to be present to what we're feeling about a situation or another person. What am I assuming? Pause to question ourselves before questioning another. Why do I have such an urge to ask this question in the first place? Am I putting somebody on the spot with this question? It can be worth it to wait, to consider what our assumptions are first, instead of rushing to fill the silence with words. This is the practice of being present. In this congregation, we're always aiming to be more aware and kind with one another. We can use our experience here to practice living with surprises and learning from one another. We can practice mindful interactions. We are building a community to make space for everyone's uniqueness and to create a safe space for one another. We do this not for our own sake, but in service of our mission to deepen our lives and to be a force for healing in the world. Because we affirm human dignity for everyone, we are here to listen and to learn, to grow and encourage the growth of one another. It is an adventure of authentic interchange, real people together. This is community, and it is a gift. With grace and good humor, courage and humility and forgiveness, let us be good stewards of this gift of community. So may it be. Blessed be. Amen.